So open up to the book of James, chapter 1. And tonight I want to, we've been talking about managing emotions, and tonight I want to talk about overcoming lust in James chapter 1. James, in we'll deal with verses 13 down to verse number 18. While you're finding that, I was reading about a pastor who was talking to a young man who claimed he couldn't stop his pattern of yielding to lust, giving in. And the young man knew it was wrong, but he also said, talking to his pastor, it was inevitable. Therefore, it really wasn't his fault, since God created him with such strong desires, with such strong lusts, that it really wasn't his fault. And the pastor, being wise, said to the young man, he said, what if right before you were getting ready to give in to a lust, I stepped in and I said, here are 10 $100 bills, and you can have this if you don't yield, if you don't do this. He said, what would you do? He said, well, I wouldn't do it. I would want the 10 $100 bills. And the pastor said, what can we learn by that? What happened to that irresistible force you couldn't control? And he said, there's one principle you learn, and that is this. One passion might seem irresistible until a greater passion comes along. And that was the truth. That's the principle. And really, that's what we're going to learn here in James. If we want to learn to overcome lusts, or overcome passions that sometimes pull us out of the way and keep us from doing what God would have us do, the way we overcome one lower passion is to have a superior, higher passion. And that is a passion for righteousness and a passion for God. Now, with all that in mind, that's what we're going to see here in James tonight. James is dealing with a very important issue here as we come to James chapter 1. In verse number 13, he's dealing with this issue of controlling lust. In fact, why don't you look down to verse 14. We'll look at that. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Now, James is going to teach us then how to deal with these passions within, these lusts. And there are some lessons that we can learn here from this. But first, let me give you just a little bit of context. Remember, part of the theme of the book of James is he's dealing with this issue of true Christianity. Don't just tell me you're a Christian, show me you're a Christian. And so far in James 1, he asks the question, how do you react to trials? A lot of times, how we respond to trials will determine the genuineness of our faith. But also the next question is, how do I respond to temptation? And that's the issue that he's dealing with here in verses 13 down to verse 18. Just a few preliminary statements about temptation. First of all, testing and temptation are not the same. Although we might see the same word here in James where it says in verse number 3, knowing this, that the trying of your faith works patience, the word trying there, and the word tempted in verse 13 is the same word in the Greek, but it's not the same thing. It's a neutral word, but the context determines the word. And so there's a difference between testing and temptation. God will use testing to build us up. Satan will use temptation to tear us down. And then there's another thing I want you to know, and that is don't think that temptation will decrease when you become a Christian. If anything, your temptations will increase when you become a child of God. Because now Satan will attack. He will try to appeal to certain desires and passions and lusts in you. And so remember that. And then another thought is this. Don't think that you can grow to the point where you cannot fall. Everybody understands that any Christian at any point in their Christian life can fall. We can fail if we're not careful. Write down 1 Corinthians 10:12. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he what? Lest he fall. And so don't get to the point where you feel like, well, it can't happen to me. Someone said a proud man tempts the devil to tempt him. But with all that in mind, James is talking about here overcoming lust. And there are three lessons that I want you to see here in our passage tonight. If you're taking notes, write down number one. Here's the first thing. Assume the responsibility for lust or passion. Look in verse 13 again. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. In order to properly deal with temptation and lust, we have to know the origin of it. And James tells us the origin. But first of all, he shows us where the origin is not. Let no man say that he's tempted of God. First, James looks upward and he says, don't let anyone say that when you are dealing with lust and temptation, that God is the ultimate cause for your temptation or for the passions that are in you. In fact, where it says, let no man say, this is a third person imperative. That it's a strong command. And you know why James says that? Because there were people already in his day that were rationalizing and that were saying that it was ultimately God is responsible. And James is basically saying, stop saying that. When he says, let no one say, that's middle voice, which we could translate it like this. Let no one say to himself, or let no one excuse himself. In other words, people might not have been saying it out loud, but they were saying to themselves that ultimately the reason why they were failing to overcome temptation is because ultimately God made me this way. This was ultimately the Lord. And so James is saying, don't think that way. Some were actually thinking that. In fact, some of the Jewish rabbis of that day believed that God was at least indirectly responsible for sin and temptation in the world. They believed that God gave what is called the Yetzer Hara, that is, the evil impulse. That was from God, as some of them reason. In fact, one Greek scholar, Zodiates, writes it like this. He says, God has ordained that I should yield to the temptation under which I have fallen. I have been driven to sin, not by God himself, since he hates sin, but by the very circumstance in which God has placed me. God is the ultimate cause, and therefore I should absolve myself of the responsibility. That's the way they were reasoning. Ultimately, God made me the way I am, and so therefore they were laying it at God's feet. Now that was true in James' day. But you know, we can go back farther than that. That goes all the way back to the very beginning in the Garden of Eden. Because as soon as man fell, he didn't take responsibility. What did he do? He blamed God. You remember that, right? The woman which you gave me. Husbands, that's a pretty good way to, you know, deal with things, right? It was my wife. The woman you gave me, she ate the fruit, and then she gave it to me. What was I supposed to do? And so I ate. And then Eve's excuse was even better. She said, the serpent deceived me, and I ate. God, why did you even let that serpent into the garden? Really, they were just laying it really at God's feet. They were saying it's God's fault. God, if you hadn't put us in this garden, if you hadn't allowed that a serpent to come into the garden, then we wouldn't be in this mess that we're in. And so therefore, ultimately, they were blaming the Lord. But not only do we see this in James' day, and we see it in Adam's day, we see this today. Did you ever notice that we live in a day when nobody wants to be responsible for their actions? Nobody wants to be responsible for their own decisions or choices or their own lusts. We're always trying to shift the blame over to someone else or something else. Will Rogers once said, there are two great movements in the history of America, the passing of the buffalo and the passing of the buck. We're always wanting to pass the buck. And James here comes along and he says, you can't blame God because you can't control your passions. Don't come along and blame God. Because what does he say? Look in verse 13. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. God is holy. He cannot be tempted, and he cannot and will not tempt any man. Why? Because before you tempt someone with evil, you must be evil yourself. And God is holy. God is righteous. And so he does not tempt. He's not involved. He's not remotely involved in sin. He's removed from it. Now, people will, again, they'll try to blame other things. And indirectly, in a way, they're blaming God. They'll say, well, it's the ghetto that I was raised in. It was the glands that I inherited. It was the parents that raised me. And again, today we live in a society where the generation is basically saying it is not my fault. And people say it's not your fault that you're the way you are. A woman had written to say that she had tried every form of therapy she knew and still could not break a self-destructive habit. This is what she wrote to a columnist. Here's how the columnist responded. Said this: "The first step you must take is to stop blaming yourself. Your compulsive behavior is not your fault. Refuse to accept blame, and above all, do not blame yourself for what you cannot control. Heaping guilt on yourself only adds to your stress, low self-esteem, worry, depression, feelings of inadequacy, and dependence on others. Let your feelings go." And again, that's the prevailing idea in modern society today. It's not your fault. Victimism has gained so much influence that as far as society is concerned, there's practically no such thing as sin anymore. No such thing. And by the way, it's radically changed society. It's radically changed how human behavior is looked upon. Just one illustration from the book, The Vanishing Conscience. It tells a story of a San Francisco supervisor. He claimed that he murdered a fellow supervisor because he ate too much junk food. Especially Hostess Twinkies made him act irrationally. And I'm not making this up. This was an actual story. This is the famous Twinkie defense that was born. The reason he lashed out in anger and killed a fellow worker was because he ate too many Hostess Twinkies. And then, get this, they ruled that the junk food resulted in diminished mental capacity, which mitigated the killer's guilt. And so he only served a very short time and was out of prison before you knew it. It was the junk food that I ate. A man who was shot and paralyzed while committing burglary in New York recovered damages from the store owner who shot him. This is according to another article. His attorney told a jury that the man was, first of all, a victim of society, driven to crime by economic disadvantage. Now, the lawyer said, he's a victim of the insensitivity of the man who shot him because of that man's callous disregard of the thief's plight as a victim. The poor criminal will be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And his attorney argued that he deserves some redress. He deserves some compensation from the store owner, this man that he tried to rob. Well, the jury agreed. The store owner ended up having to pay a large settlement. Several months later, the same man, still in his wheelchair, was arrested while committing another armed robbery. But that's the way things are today. It's nobody's fault. We're all victims. And James tells us the very first thing that we have to do is we have to stop blaming everyone else. We have to stop blaming God and our environment and our circumstances, because we've allowed ourselves to give in to desires that are wrong. Stop blaming others and stop saying that God, it's God's fault, or it's God's role in this plight of mine. Let me tell you God's role in temptation. The Bible is very clear on it. 1 Corinthians 10:13. There is no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But what does the Bible say? God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation make a way of escape so that you can be able to bear it. Every temptation is controlled by God. You know, you can't say, well, I was tempted in a way that nobody else was tempted. It overwhelmed me. No, it was controlled by God. You had a choice. And next, God never allowed you to bear something that no one else ever bore. This temptation that you face is common to man, and it's conquerable. God always leaves a way out. So stop blaming God. But now James, he looks upward, but then he looks inward. Look at verse 14. But every man is tempted. Listen to this. Here's how temptation works. When he is drawn away of his own what? His own lust. It comes from our own sin nature. Our own lust. It'll be a great day in our life when we realize that we have a sin nature, and this sin nature is still active in us. And it's like a filthy fountain that is constantly spewing up evil. And this sin nature has to be subdued, and it has to be killed, and it has to be put to rest in our heart. Every day there's a battle with this sin nature that's inside of us. You know, the devil gets blamed for a lot of things that he doesn't do. There's a lot of things that people do that come out of our own heart, our own sinful lusts, our own passions. Write down Mark 7:21. Jesus said this, "For from within, that is out of the heart of man, proceeds evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, blasphemy, pride, foolishness." Jesus said, all these evil things come from within. It's part of our sin nature. And that's what we have to realize. The first thing that we have to do is assume responsibility for our own desires. We have to understand that it comes from within. We can become captive to our own desires if we allow these desires to rule us. We can become prisoners to them. And so God is going to tell us how we can overcome these. Now, all of us have legitimate desires, but it's when those legitimate desires cross out of the normal realm of obedience to God's law and they go beyond into the disobedience of God's law. You know, sleeping is normal, but laziness is a sin, and so on. Marital intimacy is normal, but adultery is a sin, and so on. And so when these desires within us attach themselves to an evil thing, basically these routine desires that God has placed within us become runaway desires. And by the way, friend, that doesn't happen overnight. That happens through a long process of not thinking correctly, of evil thinking, of not mortifying the sin nature. And so we have to be careful about this very thing. And then next, James looks outward to deception. Look in verse 14. "But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And when lust hath conceived, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brings forth death." Next, James says that this is how it happens. It begins with a lust on the inside, and then there's the outward enticement. And by the way, Satan knows exactly what buttons to push to cause people to yield to lust sometimes. It's like this outward enticement. And by the way, the word enticed here is actually a hunting or fishing term. It means to lure away. It has the idea of baiting a hook. It's the idea of a snare and a trap. And so James is really using the terms of an outdoorsman. He's giving the picture of a fisherman. And James is a master illustrator. What does a fisherman do? A fisherman basically uses the right lure to get Mr. Bass, to lure him out, right? Isn't that what a fisherman does? Doesn't a fisherman lie to the fish? He says, "I want to bless you. I want to give you a good meal here." And so he uses this lure, and the bass sees it, and he comes out, and then he's hooked. That's exactly how Satan works. Satan goes, I want to be good to you. I want to bless you. And so he lures you out with the right lure. And the Bible says that every man is drawn away of his own lust and enticed, it tells us, and so on. Now, so here's the first thing. We have to assume responsibility. But write down, here's number two. James says, analyze the result of lust. What's the result of this? What happens when we give in to these passions? Look in verse number 15 again. "When lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death." And what James is describing to us here is the end result of lust. You know, one of the biggest ways to overcome temptation is to know where it all ends. And it ends with death. James says, when lust has conceived. And now again, James is using another illustration here. Now he's using the illustration of a birth. First, there's the conception when lust has conceived. The two parents of sin is inward lust, outward temptation. And James says, when these two come together, there's the evil child of sin. There's the conception, there's the child sin. And then finally, there is the completion. What is the completion of it? It's death. Sin, lust, then sin, then death. Someone called this the devil's LSD. Lust, sin, death. And so, he's helping us to see the end result here. You know, one way to overcome passion and lust and not yield to wrong desires is to see what it's going to bring about in the end. Because let me tell you something about Satan. He's good at fooling you and giving you an image in your mind that's just not real. But he never shows you the real end result. I heard of a pastor in Florida. His church was close to a brewery. And this brewery had big, beautiful billboard signs that had people of distinction drinking their beer. And it had at the bottom of it a caption that said, "The finest product of the brewer's art." And the pastor would drive by that every day. He got tired of seeing this beautiful picture of people, you know, enjoying themselves, having a great time, reading that caption, "The finest product of the brewer's art." So he decided he would do something. He had a big billboard in front of his church, and he had an artist in his church draw the picture of a man laying in an alleyway in his own filth, half dead, and he put at the bottom of the picture, "The finished product of the brewer's art." You see, the devil, he wants you to see the finest product, but he doesn't tell you the finished product. And here James is giving us the finished product, and it's death. It's death. Now, here's the last thing, the third thing, and this is what I want to really focus on tonight. Number one, assume the responsibility. Secondly, analyze the result of lust. But here's the third thing, apply the remedy. What's the remedy? Look in verse 16. "Do not err, my beloved brethren. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning." James here gives us the remedy. This is solid advice for overcoming lust. And first of all, it starts with right thinking. Just write down the right thoughts. Notice where he says, "Do not err." The word "err" means to go off course by thinking wrong thoughts. This is a prohibition imperative. We could literally translate it, "Stop being deceived." And that's what James is saying to these people here, people perhaps in his own congregation. Stop being deceived by the devil and by the world. Stop allowing your mind to be deceived. There are some people there, they were entertaining Satan's lies. That's the first place that Satan starts to get a Christian out of line, is he starts planting lies into your mind. And people believe those lies. James says, stop that. Stop being deceived about what Satan is saying. And by the way, remember the context here. The context is trials and testings. So here's how it works. You may be going through a test, and you may be questioning, why is God putting me through this test? And right at that moment when you're vulnerable, Satan will come along and Satan will say, "Why is God treating you this way? You deserve better. Let me help you. Let me give you something better." And if you begin to believe the lies of Satan at that moment, you've gone astray. You've erred in your thinking. I remember when I was a younger preacher, I had a man in our church when I was pastoring in Louisiana, a man by the name of J. Harold Smith. He was a great, great preacher. He came to our church and preached a famous sermon called God's Three Deadlines. It was a powerful sermon. I remember picking him up at the hotel that day, and as I was driving him to the church, he just said, "Brother Jerry, you drive, I'll pray." And he prayed the whole way out loud in the car, praying for the service, and he was sweating profusely by the time I got to church with him. And he got up and he preached, and it was such a powerful sermon. And he was just a godly, godly man. But I remember one time taking him out to lunch, and he told me the story of his son. He had a little boy, about 6 years old. His name was Sonny. And he said that one day, some bullies doused him with gasoline, his son. And then they lit him on fire. And his son literally burned to death. But before his son died, he said he got there to the hospital, and he sat there beside his son, and his son in the bed, and he was black with being burnt. His little fingers burned down to the nubs, he said. And it was just a terrible thing for him, a terrible ordeal for him to go through. And he said while he was there looking at his son, he said Satan came and began to whisper to him and said, "How could God allow this to happen to you? How could God treat you this way? Here you are all over the country preaching and doing God's work, and God comes along and He does this to you." And Dr. Smith told me, I'll never forget, he said, at that moment in my life, it was one of the most difficult temptations I have ever faced in my life. And he said, finally, by the grace of God, I said to the devil, "Devil, go back to the pit where you came from. I'm going to trust my Father." What an incredible testimony that was. But I want to tell you, friend, that's exactly how Satan works. And he will whisper into your ear that God is not good to you and God is holding out on you. Remember, that was Satan's first move in the Garden of Eden. Remember what he said to Eve? God, he doesn't want you to know good and evil. God's withholding from you. He doesn't want you to be as gods. He got Eve to think negatively about God. And this is what James is talking about here. Satan's strategy today is the same thing. He wants you to be dissatisfied with God's will for your life where you are. And if he can get you to be dissatisfied, then, friend, he's got you to be dissatisfied with your circumstances, angry at your lot in life. And he wants you to lack confidence in the goodness of God. A single person wonders, why hasn't God given me a mate? A married person wonders, why has God given me this mate? And he wants you to get bitter at God. He wants you to feel like God's ripping you off. Erwin Lutzer wrote this. He said, when you doubt God's goodness, you hug sins tightly to your bosom, afraid that God will rob you of your crutch. And so James comes along and James says, stop being deceived. Do not err, my beloved brethren. Right thinking, but then write this down. Right theology. Right theology. Because look what James says in verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from where? From above. It cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no veritableness, neither shadow of turning. Here James is very theological, and he gives us some wonderful theology that we can apply to help us in this time of testing or temptation. And he teaches us about the character of God, about the nature of God. God is a good God. Notice a few facts here. First of all, God gives only good gifts. Again, look at verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift. Two different Greek words here used for gift. The first, dosis, refers to the act of giving, and dorema refers to the object that is given. I want to focus on the second word first in verse 17, where it says, where it's dorema, the gift itself. The gifts that God gives are perfect for us. Did you know that God gives you perfect gifts for you? You might not think so, but He knows exactly what you need. And He gives you good gifts. Even the trials that you go through. Remember, the context of this is going through trials. Did you know that even the trials that you have to bear, in a sense, are a gift from God? Why? Because of the end result. You know, I've talked to some Christians years and years after a trial, and they say, well, I was going through it, it was tough, but now as I look back on it, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. One of the best things that ever happened to me. You see, that's the idea here. James says God gives us good gifts. He gives us perfect gifts. But also the way in which God gives, that's dosis, referring to the act of giving. Not only is the gift that He gives us right and perfect, but the manner in which He gives it is good and gracious. You know, sometimes we may give reluctantly to God, but let me tell you something. God never gives reluctantly to us. He always gives in a very gracious manner. You see, the value of the gift can be diminished in the way that it is given. But God, when He gives us these gifts, He does it in a very loving, in a very gracious manner, in a very generous manner. He gives us all these things. And then thirdly, God's giving is constant. Look again where it says, and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom there's no veritableness, neither shadow of turning. The word cometh down, present participle. It keeps coming down. God doesn't give occasional gifts. He's constantly giving gifts. Today, when we woke up, He was giving to us. He's been giving to us all day. And He will continue to give because He's a gracious giver. His mercies are new every morning. He gives us sleep. He gives us food to nourish us. He gives us sun to light our day, to make us healthy. He gives us clothes to wear, a roof over our head. He gives us air to fill our lungs so that we can live. He gives us people to love, family and friends. He gives us our health. Even when He withholds things from us, again, that in itself is a gift from God. And here's the next thing James says. God does not change. Look again in verse 17, with whom there is no veritableness, neither shadow of turning. You see, James calls God the Father of lights. This was an ancient Jewish reference to God as the Creator. The lights referred to are the sun, moon, and stars. James chooses that title because it fits his illustration. You see, God created the sun, moon, and stars, and they're always there, and they're always shining, and they don't change. Now, from our perspective, it looks like the sun and the moon and the stars are constantly changing, but they're not. Sometimes shadows come and block out the sun or the moon or the light, but they have not changed and they have not moved. They're still there. And so it is with God. God created them not to change. And also, God is a God who does not change. The Bible says this in Malachi 3:6, I am the Lord, I change not. This is the character of God. We call this the immutability of God. He does not change. Grudem writes this. He's a theologian. He says, God is unchanging in His being, perfections, purposes, promises, yet God does act and feel emotions. He acts and feels differently in response to different situations. Simply put, God is unchanging, yet He still relates to His people. He's immutable, but He's not immobile. But here's the thing. This should give us great comfort. When we think about the changelessness of God, you say, how does this apply to us? Simply this way. God's attitude towards you, His love towards you, has never changed. Never. His love for you is the same now as it's always has been. I read a book about this by the Puritan Edward Pierce. It's called A Beam of Divine Glory, The Unchangeableness of God. And this whole book dwells on the attribute of God's changelessness and how that this can bring great comfort to the Christian. But let me just read you one excerpt of what he says, talking about God's dispensations towards us, how they do not change. He said, He did smile, but now he frown. He did lift up, now He cast down. In other words, God doesn't do this. God's constantly the same. Your God changes not, he says. His heart, His counsel, His covenant, His love are still the same towards you as ever they always were. Now, it might look like that when we go through a difficult experience that God's disposition towards us has changed, but friend, it has not. It has not. God still loves us the same way. Just like the clouds might block out the light of the sun, the clouds of trials and difficulties sometimes in our life might block out what we think is God's disposition of changing, but He has not changed. One day Spurgeon was walking with a friend through the countryside, and they saw a barn with a weather vane on top, and in the weather vane would change with the wind, and it had on it, God is love. And the friend said to Spurgeon, I don't think that's right. It's basically saying God's love changes. And Spurgeon says, no, you're not reading it right. What he's saying is no matter which way the wind blows, God is still love. Amen. And that's the way we should see that. God is not moody. He doesn't have a bad day. His attitude towards you does not change. He loves you just as much today as He always have. His face is still shining towards you. Now, let me wrap this up. You say, how does this help me overcome passion? Remember at the beginning of the sermon, I said that the way to overcome one passion is to have a superior passion. And the way we overcome passions that would get us out of the way is to have a passion for God, a passion for righteousness. And this is, I think, what James is trying to do here in this passage. He's trying to show us that we have a good God. And whatever Satan comes along and says, God's withholding from you, that's how he tempts you. That's how things get out of control in our life. We need to be reminded that every good and perfect gift is from above. You see, here's the bottom line. If you find all of your satisfaction and joy in God and in your relationship to God, you know what? Temptation will lose its power in your life. And you know what? Those other passions will be subdued when you have a higher passion for God. Let me illustrate it to you like this, and then we're done. I read a book about the life of Augustine, the great early church father. And before he was saved, he was a very immoral man and lived a terribly immoral life. But he talks about his own conversion, and he calls it a legacy of sovereign joy. He talks about the time when he was converted to Christ, that he had a sovereign joy that overwhelmed him. And so all of a sudden now, all of his joy, all of his fulfillment came in his relationship to God. And this passion and this joy that he had in God overcame all of the other sinful passions he's ever had. And you know what? He was never tempted with any of those things ever again. You know why? Because he had a higher passion, and that was a relationship and a love for God in his life. Friend, we need to realize that we have a great God who loves us. We have to develop a walk with Him, a passion for Him, and that will help us to overcome any lower sinful passion in our life. And that's the message that James is giving us here. Let's bow for prayer tonight. And so, Father, help us to see that You are indeed a great God. Great is Your faithfulness. There's no shadow of turning with You. And Your compassions fail not, as the songwriter said. So help us, Lord, to learn the remedy for overcoming lust, and that is to realize Your goodness, that You're not withholding anything from us, that every good and perfect gift we've already been given by You, and how we thank You. So, Lord, help us to overcome sin and temptation in our life, to find all of our joy, all of our satisfaction in You and in You alone. And Father, we pray all these things in Jesus' wonderful, matchless name. Amen.